Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Kevin Williamson of National Review, and for Jim Garrity today, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, crazy martinis for you as usual. And Kevin, the good martini today stems from one of the Benghazi hearings that took place this week. The exchange we're going to play here in three different parts is between Congressman Trey Gowdy of South Carolina, Republican, a former prosecutor, and you can tell that by the way he asked these questions, and Mike Mullen, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and again, the co-chair of this Accountability Review Board. This first clip is Gowdy getting into Mullen's face about the fact that Hillary Clinton was never interviewed, specifically since the fact that she was charged by a previous Accountability Review Board in 1998, I'm guessing in the wake of the East Africa embassy bombings, that it's her job to determine if embassies are at sufficient security risk that they need to be closed. And here's how that went.
We had it in 1998 that the Secretary of State herself review the facilities and consider closing them if they are not safe.
I think we have pulled people out where it wasn't safe over the course of that
year. But my question, Admiral, is you never interviewed the Secretary of State about whether she accepted and performed a responsibility given to her by a previous Accountability Review Board.
And then another topic of confrontation was that Mullen apparently told the Congressman Jason Chaffetz that he had given a State Department counsel, Cheryl Mills, a heads up that Charlene Lamb wouldn't be a great witness, and he was asked to explain why.
Having sat down with Lamb, it was the first time I'd met her in our interview, that I thought there could be better witnesses to represent the department.
Better witnesses from what standpoint?
At that time and place with respect to the events which had occurred in Benghazi.
Well, Admiral, wasn't she a fact witness? I mean, the facts pick the witnesses. I mean, the State Department doesn't pick witnesses. The facts pick the witnesses. She was a fact witness, right?
So, Kevin, other than perhaps expecting way too much compliance with anything any Accountability Review Board says, looks like Trey Gowdy got some good points in here, and hopefully this raises even more questions.
That last bit sounded like a fairly naked bureaucratic butt covering, which is what one expects from this sort of thing. Here's what drives me crazy about this whole debate. Democrats all the time are saying there's no scandal here, there's nothing to see here, why are we investigating, where's the scandal? It doesn't matter whether there's a scandal here or not. We had American diplomatic and security personnel killed. There were obvious security failures. We have questions about what happened, how it happened, why it happened, who made various calls about various decisions, and what we can do to prevent this sort of thing from happening again. It doesn't have to be a scandal to be worthy of investigation. The fact that you want to talk to the Secretary of State about this is something that you might want to do whether you think she did the wrong thing or whether you think she did the right thing. Whether you think that they're, you know, in some way culpable here, whether it's scandalous, whether it's not scandalous, you want to know what happened. And when you refuse to speak to the Secretary of State, when you refuse to speak to various material witnesses, you're preventing people from figuring out just factually what happened and, most important, how we can go about making sure this thing doesn't happen again in the future. If the Republicans are reduced to treating this thing like a prosecution, what do you expect when you're not getting answers that are forthcoming and complete and honest? I don't see really any other way to go about it. So whether it's a scandal, whether it's not a scandal, it's the sort of thing that needs to be aggressively investigated and documented.
On to the fight against Obamacare over in the Senate in particular. Mike Enzi and David Vitter has really been the voice on this, trying to remove this special treatment for members of Congress, their staff, administration officials, and so forth, because of a very public exemption and additional subsidies offered by the Office of Personnel Management at the beginning of August. Senator Vitter has pointed out that certain members on the Democratic side in the Senate, and he specifically singles out his Louisiana colleague Mary Landrieu, are basically lying to their constituents. He found a letter from one constituent where Mary Landrieu said that the notion that they are getting special treatment, quote, could not be further from the truth, unquote. Vitter's response is, Senator Landrieu is trying to mislead you, to put it kindly. Others might say she is lying. And so, Kevin, this wasn't some secret directive. I think we knew pretty much either the day of or the day after that the Office of Personnel Management had done this, and this special treatment is in effect, despite the fact that the law specifically says there shall be no special treatment.
But it's not even clear that the OPM has any sort of legal or statutory justification for doing this. I mean, never mind the fact in the ACA itself, it says that they're not supposed to be these exceptions. This is really a question of contracting for personnel services, and there are particular forms and processes you have to go through to do that. The OPM does not have the legal ability to just make statutory changes about how they do this sort of thing, and especially in the case of adding subsidies that have certainly no legal justification and arguably legal prohibition. The exemptions that are being offered to unions and various favored businesses and, of course, political interests, including Hill staffers, really point to the problems with not just this bill, but with how we try to govern this country these days. You know, the ACA is shaping up into being essentially another version of the federal tax code that's so full of exemptions and exclusions and credits and special treatments for this interest group and that interest group that it's hard to argue that you have a country in which everyone is living under the same law. If you're a member of Congress, if you work for Congress, if you work for a politically connected union, you've got one health care law you live under. If you're someone else, you've got a different health care law you live under. That's not rule of law. This is arbitrary exercise of political power. This is exactly why you have a constitution. It's why you have division of power. It's why you have basically the American system to ensure that everyone is, as we used to like to say, equal before the law. We're creating essentially a caste system. If you spend much time in Washington, God help me, I'm headed there in the morning, you are living in a different country when you're in Washington, D.C. You know, it used to be that when you came to Manhattan, you felt like you were in a different country from the rest of the country. You know, if you're from Lubbock, Texas, as I am, you spend any time in New York City, it feels a lot like living in a foreign country. But Washington these days feels much more like a foreign country than New York does. It's this insulated, self-serving group of people who really believe that they are above the laws and the programs and the mandates that they've created for everyone else.
Kevin, a real quick follow-up before we get to the crazy martini. Do you think the American people will be justifiably outraged if this is well enough known, or do you think they just expect this from Washington now and it's not going to be that big of an outrage?
I'm a little disappointed in my fellow countrymen, honestly. There's been a lot of developments coming out of the Capitol in the last couple of years, that if you're not going to tar and feather people over this stuff, what are you going to tar and feather them over? These exemptions are a middle finger in the air to the rest of the country saying, hey, look, we know this law might kind of suck, and we said you could keep your health care if you can keep it, which you can't. We certainly don't want to live under it, so we're going to exempt ourselves and create special subsidies for ourselves. But you yokels, hey, screw you. You're going to do what we say. This is the sort of thing that people have to, at some point, stand up against. It's an entrenched attitude. It's in both parties to some extent. At some point, the American people are just going to have to say no. They need to be reminded we're people with sedition in our national DNA. We were born of treason and revolution, and at some point we say enough.
Faithful listeners to the Three Martini Lunch may remember one of Kevin's appearances earlier this year where we were haranguing Mayor Bloomberg for one of his nanny state intrusions. I don't even remember which one it was. And Kevin, in passing, said, you know, as horrible as Mayor Bloomberg is, in a few months we're really going to miss him, because no matter who wins this year from any party, it's going to be far worse than what we have now. So now that the primaries are over, it's Bill de Blasio, the Democrat, against Joe Lota, the Republican. And Kevin is here to explain why either one would be atrocious. Go ahead.
I don't want to treat these guys as equal, because I do think Lota would be a far preferable mayor, although I think his chances of being elected are slim to none. The problem with Joe Lota is that the main thing he can do to sell himself is say, look, I'm a competent manager. I ran the MTA. That's a hard case to make for New Yorkers when you're saying, hey, I'm the guy in charge of our crappy, filthy, rat-infested, late, never anywhere it's supposed to be on time, dysfunctional subway system. Trust me to run the whole city. Now, I think that Joe actually makes a pretty good case that, you know, he was only there for about a year, and he did make some key improvements. And I think he's actually a pretty competent and capable guy in a lot of ways. But, you know, I spent years having this little joke on Twitter called the Committee to Horsewhip Joe Lota, just simply because anyone who uses MTA transit in this city hates it. It's third world. If you spend any time in, you know, any country that has a sort of civilized system, and the thing that really pisses you off about it is you come home to New York and realize that we spend a lot more money on our crappy, late, never working, ever anywhere on time dysfunctional subway system than countries and cities that have pretty functional and clean and non-rat infested ones do. And Joe Loda has to come out, and his argument is, yeah, but if I hadn't been the one managing it, it would have been even worse than it is. And that's a hard case to make. Now, de Blasio, of course, is basically running the Francois Hollande program, saying he's going to institute new taxes on the rich, people who make $500,000 a year or more. And while that doesn't worry me so much personally, since, you know, as a right-wing journalist in Manhattan, I'm not really expecting to hit the $500,000 and up mark anytime real soon, the fact is that this city as a business proposition doesn't work without those people here. Most of the people in that income bracket are finance people. Finance really is the economic anchor of New York City. It's the source of a tremendous amount of both the city's and the state's tax revenue. And what these idiots have not figured out yet, and it surprises me that Bloomberg, who should know this world better than most people, hasn't figured this out, is that the days of when you're a finance guy, when you're a stockbroker, when you're an investment banker, and you have to have an office on Wall Street, those days were over decades ago. There's no reason anyone in finance, a hedge fund, an investment banker, private equity guy, anyone else has to be in lower Manhattan, which is why so much of this business has moved to places like Stamford, Connecticut, to Charlotte, to Houston, places like that, and of course, increasingly offshore. Capital is going to go where it wants. And if you're someone like me, you know, 1% here or there on your taxes is no big deal. But if you're $1 billion a year enterprise or $100 billion a year enterprise, yeah, 1% matters a lot, which is why there are more Fortune 500 headquarters in Texas now than there are in New York. If you told someone 30 years ago that was going to be the case, they would have thought you were smoking crack. Bill de Blasio, if he manages to get his plan through Albany, which of course has to approve these changes to the tax code, probably won't end up collecting any extra revenue because he will simply chase out these highly productive and profitable businesses and the highly paid people who go along with them. Because Stamford, Connecticut's only a 35-minute ride away on the train.
Is that train working on time? I don't know if that's the same one.
God, don't get me started on the Metro North. You know, I used to live in Norwalk, Connecticut, so I took that train to work every day. And our poor publisher, Jack Fowler, lives up in Milford, which is, you know, on a good day, close to a two-hour train ride on the Metro North. You know, they closed the thing down for wet leaves. You're in New England. Fall comes every year. How do you not know how to handle wet leaves?
Do you hold your nose and vote Loda, or do you just stay home?
I have been conscientiously objecting to active participation in the American political system for a few years now because I believe it to be corrupt beyond the price I'm willing to pay to participate in it. So, of course, living in New York, me not voting hardly matters because, you know, it's not like we've got a real center of Rand Paul type action out here. I've not voted in a good long while now, and I don't know that I will.
Kevin, thanks for filling in. Have a great weekend.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you.
Same here. Kevin Williamson of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join Jim and me on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch. Have a good weekend, everyone.